can step right up. The show's about to begin. Forget your troubles and raise your cups. Into this moment, it will never happen again.
This is Off Stage and On the Air, performance number 695. I am Lisa Sheps. I am joined by my guest co-host, Ms. Andrea Nunez.
Hello, everyone. Excited to be here today.
You are listening to both of us at KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby, streaming live at KOOP.org. Remember, if it's theater, it's on Off Stage and On the Air. Don't go away.
Hurry, hurry, step right up. The show's about to begin. Forget your troubles and raise your cup. Step right up. Feast your eyes on the wonders of this world. Oh, yeah.
I met a nice guy at the dog track. He was tall, he was Greek, he was possibly gay. He needed a green card, I needed the cash. We got married in Passaic last May. You should have.
It is Wednesday, November 16th, 2022. On the show today, we have Austin Playhouse and their show, The One Act Play That Goes Wrong. Then later, we'll be talking to City Theater and their production of Faith Healer. And of course, Andrea and I will have a lively discussion of the world of theater in Chicago, Austin, New York, Boston, and Pittsburgh. Don't go away.
So you can make your life better.
So you're married?
Make your life better. Andrea, say something.
Make my life better.
Well, you couldn't hear because you were not wearing headphones. So that was what was that's what they were saying in the music. So
gotcha.
Everybody else could hear it but you. But welcome. First of all, I need to say in my intro, I mispronounced your first name and I know better than that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's Andrea.
Andrea.
Not Andrea.
No, not Andrea.
Not Andrea. It's Andrea. There you go.
Or Andy,
but I call you Andrea because that's what you asked. So I'm happy to have you back here co-hosting with me.
Mm-hmm.
How's it feel?
I'm so grateful to be here, surrounded by wonderful artists and, of course, by the wonderful Lisa.
Me too. Actually, I have to laugh. Sorry, I'm going to just do a non sequitur. Before we went on the air, I was telling our guests, who we will introduce in about a second, that as soon as I go on the air, that's when texts start coming in. And sure enough, I just got 3 texts on my phone. So let's introduce the folks that are here with us. Ben Wolf, welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Toby Miner, welcome
Hello.
Back. Actually, welcome back, everybody. Huck Huckabee, welcome back.
Yay.
But Huck, it's been a while since you've been on the show.
I can't remember the last time I was here.
It's been a long time.
I know.
But you have been on. So I want to take this moment to thank Kim Simpson for another wonderful International Folk Bazaar. Did y'all know it was Icelandic Day? National Icelandic Day?
No, I know that. No.
Didn't know that either. And it's funny thing because coincidentally, I was playing Icelandic music this morning when I woke up. That's a lie.
I was going to say that's
good on you.
Yeah, wow. That's a total lie. But I just thought I'd say it. Let's talk about, we had a couple of openings on Broadway this week. And one was Kimberly Akimbo, which is a transfer from, I think, the Atlantic Stage off Broadway. Did anybody know anything about Kimberly Akimbo?
I heard of, what did I hear? Oh gosh, now I'm just totally blanking. I heard it was written by the same folks who did something that I'd heard of, and now it's all gone.
Well, it's written by David Lindsay Abaire.
There we go.
And Janine Tesori. Who wrote the music. But this is just an amazing show. On the aggregator, did they like it? It got, out of 16 possible reviews, it got 16 thumbs ups.
Wow.
So if you're doing math, that means it got 0 thumbs down. and 0 middle of the road. But let me read the description as came from their website. Tony Award winner Victoria Clark stars as Kim, a bright and funny Jersey teen who happens to look like a 72-year-old lady. And yet her aging disease may be the least of her problems. Forced to maneuver family secrets, borderline personalities, and possible felony charges, Kim is determined to find happiness in a world where not even time is on her side. We did mention that it was written by David Lindsay Abair and Janine Tesori. It was a play originally written by David Lindsay Abair, and then they turned it into a musical. And when it was off Broadway, it got like total accolades. And again, this time, same thing. My computer is just frozen. Okay, it has just come back to life. Jesse Green reviewed it for the New York Times. And for some reason, I wrote this telling myself to read the whole thing. So I'm going to read the first paragraph and a half. Jesse Green says, quote, Broadway reliability churns out several tourist bait extravaganzas a year, the kind that features sequins, sing-alongs, and profits. Smallish, thoughtful, more narrow-cast musicals, let's call them nerdicals, are rarer. One per season, if we're lucky. Some, like Fun Home, Dear Evan Hansen, and The Band's Visit, win top Tony Awards. A Strange Loop even won the Pulitzer Prize. If they rarely last as long as, say, Six or Moulin Rouge seems likely to, these shows prove their immense value in the time they've got. That may well be the fate of Kimberly Akimbo, the profoundly funny and heartbreaking new nerdical that opened on Thursday at the Booth Theater. So she's playing a girl who has this disease that makes her look old. She will probably not live beyond the age of 16. And I should say that this show is supposed to be like a rollicking, fun-filled, fun laugh riot, from everybody says. So that's it. It's directed by Jessica Stone, and it did indeed, I was right, the Atlantic Theater Company did it last year. I just said her name, and now I lost it again. Victoria Clark evidently just runs away with this. And Victoria Clark was in Light in the Piazza. Did anybody see that when it originally came out?
No, I didn't see it. But
yeah. Beautiful. I'm not terribly fond of the show.
The music
is gorgeous. Yeah. And the set was amazing. Because I'm contrary, as we discovered before the show. I wasn't crazy about the show, but she did a great job. She played the mother. Mm-hmm. So that's where one would know her for this. One of the things that I thought was funny when he was talking about just the plot of it, she's got a very overprotective father, and worries about her, and Jesse Green in his review says her overprotective father needn't worry about her getting pregnant, she reminds him, because she went through menopause 4 years ago. Seems like an amazing piece. And he really liked Tesori's music. And he calls Tesori a chameleon because he talks about, how she did Fun Home. And she's done a whole bunch of other things that were just very, very different, and lots of different styles of music within what she does. So it's amazing. One of the things that Kimberly wants to do before she dies is goes to Great Adventure, which is a theme park in New Jersey. The final number is called Great Adventure, and it's a ukulele tune, which you don't think of a finale as a ukulele song.
Big rousing number there.
Yeah.
Yep. So some of the other critics, Broadway News' Brittany Samuel said, this new musical from the delightfully unhinged minds of David Lindsay Abair and Janine Tesori uses silliness as a weapon, one that can cut through preconceived notions about the meaning of life and stitch them back together in the same movement. Did they like it? It's Christian. Did they like it? Christian Lewis said, every once in a while, as a critic, you get to witness the stars align, writing, acting, directing, and design to create an absolutely flawless musical. Robert Hoffler of The Wrap said, Janine Tesori's music grounds a story in a way that gives the source material resonance, makes it more substantial and far more emotionally engaging. And finally, Naveen Kumar of Variety said it's unabashedly heartfelt and irresistibly funny, exceedingly rare, and almost impossible not to love. Well, clearly, 16 out of 16 felt the same way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Guess I got to go see it. I'll see you, see you later.
It's something, I've been hearing about this play, this musical, for so long, and I never really delved into the plot of it. I was just hearing about it, and my mind didn't go to a child with an aging disease from the title Kimberly Akimbo. I was thinking, because I knew it was funny, and I didn't go there. But there it is. So do we all agree we want to go see it?
Absolutely.
Sounds good. Yeah.
Sounds profound.
Is the music available yet?
It's not available yet. There's not a cast album.
Yeah.
But that song that I played at the opening, thank you for mentioning that, Huck, is called Better. There will be a link on our site, but it is a music video they did. That is recorded, and you can see it, but you don't see, it doesn't show the action of the play. So undoubtedly there will be a cast album.
Right.
So the answer to your question is no, but yes.
There was an NPR story on it this week. That's why I was familiar with
it. I heard that too.
You just wanted to let people know that you listen to NPR.
On occasion.
The other opening on Broadway was Mike Boy, that's hard to say.
Birbiglia,
yes. It's like his sixth show. It's called The Old Man in the Pool. Mike Birbiglia he's a monologuist. If you listen to This American Life, you're probably very familiar with him.
Right.
Mm-hmm. He's on it a lot, and he talked a lot. His first show, I forgot what it was called, and it was actually part, I think... Ira Glass is one of the producers of it, but he talks about his sleep. He's got a
sleep apnea.
No, he doesn't sleep apnea. He sleepwalks.
Oh.
I forgot the word. I hate growing old. I just forget really simple words. Anyway, he talked about that when he actually jumped out of a third floor window at a hotel. And so this one is another, this one says, he's returned to Broadway with a tale of life, death, and the highly coronated YMCA pool. He takes the stage at the esteemed Vivian Beaumont Theater at Lincoln Center to chronicle his coming of life middle-age story that asks the big questions. Why are we here? What's next? What happens when the items at the doctor's office that you thought were decorative become functional? So out of the 14 reviews for did they like it, 13 were thumbs up. One was middle of the road, and there were, again, if you're doing your math, no pans. This was written, the review was written for the Times by Elizabeth Vincentelli. I should say that this was directed by the guy that directs all of his stuff, Seth Barish. Mr. and Mrs. Barish's little kid. Anybody? Nobody?
No.
Okay.
Nope.
So anyway, it opened last Sunday, and he's dealing with his own, mortality. The set is by Beowulf Borrett, who is one of my favorite names to say.
It's a great name.
Yeah. She says in her review, quote, Birbiglia's virtuosity as a narrator is very real, giving him full control over the evening and the audience's reactions. When he tried to rally the crowd into a respectful moment of silence in honor of a man who had died holding his breath in a pool, the effort was engineered to fail. And it did, especially as the laughter became more performatively loud. The joke was on us. So... sounds like fun. Do y'all like Mike Birbiglia?
I don't know Mike. Did this show try out somewhere before it went to Broadway?
I'm sure it did. No, I think it toured all over the place before it went to Broadway. Yeah. And he just said, and available on Netflix or one of those is his last show, which is, I don't remember what it's called. It's two words.
Off the top of my head.
So pick your two words and that's what it's called. But this is limited run engagement playing through January 15th. But if you get a chance to see, if you go into This American Life and search him or anything, he's a wonderful storyteller.
Is he the one, or am I confusing him with somebody else? Is he the one that has an ongoing joke in his bit of the whole, the setup is, have you ever blank, blank, blank? And then he waits a second and goes, I have. Is that him?
I don't know.
Because he has a whole bit that does that they progressively get weirder and weirder and weirder. Yeah. Have you, blah, 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 blah.
I have.
And then it goes into this explanation of what that I have is. And I think that's him.
Could be. We'll do some research. I'll get my team on it.
Sweet.
Other critics said, Brittany Samuel of Broadway News said, Birbiglia. I'm getting better at the name,
you
if y'all
yes,
noticed.
You are.
Impressive.
Birbiglia. Birbiglia, Birbiglia. abides by the adage, laughter is the best medicine. In generously detailing the less than ideal fragments of his life, he reveals the many reasons we should keep relishing ours. Ranji of Did They Like It said, I was thoroughly enraptured by every word of the performance, sleek direction by Seth Barish that flew by and became the most fun I've had in a show in years, if not ever. Zing. So those are the two openings. I want to talk about, did any of y'all see this? This was, I first saw it in a blog that I read called the Onstage Blog. But it talks about an ASL interpreter for The Lion King. Did y'all see anything about this?
That sounds familiar. I think I've did read something
about it. Okay, so there was an ASL interpreter for The Lion King, who was employed by an agency that does a lot of different shows, I believe. And he was booked to interpret The Lion King, but this is a white man. And The Lion King is predominantly people of color, and it wouldn't be appropriate for him to do it. So the coordinator sheepishly called him and said, listen, would you mind stepping back and having a person of color do this because that's appropriate. He's suing for discrimination, for racial discrimination. So when I first read this on the Onstage blog, the writer agreed with him. And the way it was the way he wrote it out was this person had been under contract, and it intimated that he had been working on Lion King for a while, and just at this moment they decided to say no. But that wasn't the case, as I read a little further. But it's an interesting thing about making sure that representation happens. And when you have an interpreter, an ASL interpreter, or really any interpreter, it should match the show. And it was a really interesting conundrum. So he is indeed suing. And I, many people might know that I am currently working on a show that is both ASL and English. And my co-director, Brian Cheslick, who is the artistic director of Deaf Austin Theater, who we're co-producing with, he wrote a... I asked him if he wanted to comment on it. So he made a recording. And if I can pull it off of my phone, I'm going to play it for you here. Unfortunately, I couldn't get it to go directly into, so you're going to be listening to it from the speaker of my phone. Here it is.
Honestly, the entire thing is completely shocking. Keith Wan has been involved in the deaf community, obviously, his whole life because he's a CODA. I've never seen him interpret, but I've heard he's a very good interpreter. Unfortunately, he does not have much social awareness, as it seems, because he is not an appropriate interpreter for that job. I train interpreters, and I am a deaf interpreter myself, and when I'm offered a job, I look at the assignment. In this case, I look at the show before I accept the job to determine if I am the right fit for that job. That could be culturally the right fit, linguistically the right fit, whether I'm the right fit because of my gender, whether I'm the right fit because of my sexual orientation, political affiliation, everything before I accept that job. He should have known better, especially if he's interpreted Broadway for years. You can't interpret Broadway and theater and not know The Lion King, not know what it's about. You just can't. So he was looking for an opportunity to interpret The Lion King, and then when he got turned down, when he was asked to you know, back out of it because representation is important, he's now crying reverse racism. There's no such thing as reverse racism. And the whole thing really boils down to his own white fragility. And so, me personally, I've lost all respect for him. And I know many members of the deaf community that have now lost all respect for him and are calling for him to be ousted from the deaf community. We are also looking at filing claims against him to take away his certification because he is not acting ethically according to the Interpreter Code of Professional Conduct. So, sorry, Keith Wan, you are canceled.
So that was Brian Cheslick, co-artistic director or artistic director of Deaf Austin Theater. But he's absolutely right. We spend a lot of time talking, specifically because I'm dealing with this right now and talking to our certified interpreters that are working and talking about, especially with ASL interpreters, and I think it's more ASL interpreters than others, they've got a very rigid code of conduct that they all abide by. So I agree with Brian. I'm surprised he even accepted the job to begin with.
Well, why did they offer it?
I think that was out of ignorance. I think it wasn't, you know, I think somebody was, clearly somebody wasn't thinking. But I do know I've been in a situation where if I've done something and I constantly make mistakes. It happens. But when I learn them, I try to fix them.
Correct it,
and if part of my fixing is, God, hey, I hope you understand I made this terrible mistake. This really isn't appropriate for you as a white person to interpret this show. I hope you understand and you'll back down. The answer should have been, yeah, I get it. I'm not happy about it. Shame on you for hiring me in the first place, but I get it. And that wasn't it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And to go the extra step to sue seems just mean-spirited.
Petty, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And petty. And sort of speaks to Brian's accusation of white fragility.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I should say, by the way, that the opinions expressed here on ground, on offstage and on the air are not that of co-op's board, staff, or anybody. This simply our opinions as we're expressing them right now. But yeah, I thought it was just a very interesting thing to talk about. And as we become more and more observant of representation and making sure that we're doing the right things. The other thing that Brian and I talked about earlier today was Brian said, who is a white man, he said, I would really love to direct Once on This Island. It's my favorite musical. He said, but I'll never get to do it because I shouldn't direct Once on This Island. Mm-hmm. So these are the kinds of things that we are learning as we go. And speaking of that, in our last few minutes, I mean, this is like goes right to the same kind of idea. Raisin in the Sun, which has been playing off Broadway at the Public, starring Tanya Pinkins. Did y'all see that she wrote? It got pretty well. It was a mixed review, but Jesse Green of the New York Times did not like it, and she wrote an open letter to Jesse Green about it. Did y'all happen to see that at all?
I have not.
I would encourage folks to go at offstageonair.com. There'll be a link to not only this article from playbill.com, but also a link to the actual letter. It's a 15-page letter. And a lot of times when these things come across my desk, I read like the first couple paragraphs and then I'll skip and read that. I was just enthralled word for word because she went through and basically said the same thing that we were just talking about is as a white man, and one of the things that Jesse Green said to refresh people's memory, because we did talk about it, he said that the director was showing the story of, oh my God, I forgot, who's the main male character in Raisin in the Sun?
Oh no.
I'm going to come up with it. But Robert O'Hara was the director, Walter Lee. Sorry. He said it was that the focus was on the male characters, when in fact she went at length to talk about the racism that has gone towards strong black women. Mm-hmm. And that if you really looked at what was going on here, this show was about the black woman as the matriarch of a family, and much less about Walter Lee making sacrifices for his son. Mm-hmm. And she just step by step just read him. And it's very, very interesting and worth the read. And then I guess another question that I would ask everybody else is, I've often wondered about, you know, I've been the subject of negative reviews. Sure. We just had a review for Ground Floor Theater that I thought the critic was just off base, that mm-hmm. they didn't get something. So is it right to send a public letter going, you're wrong and this is why? Anybody have an opinion about that?
You mean to the critic?
Well, this to the critic, yeah, in this case. But it's an open letter, so it's not like a private letter going from me to Toby Miner, who just criticized my work. But it's me sending a letter to the Statesman as an open letter to Toby Miner.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah, I don't really either, no, but I'm just curious.
Your opinion is like it was his opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the public discourse, right?
Yeah. And that's what I would say, too. They're both opinions, right? And every review
Correct.
Is someone's opinion, and you can take from it what you want and leave the rest behind. So the rebuttal to that is the same way. This reviewer can take what they want from her rebuttal, from her letter. He can take pages 5 through 7 and say, oh, that's great stuff, and then the rest of it is whatever. It's opinion. We should all be able to express our opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, true. She did say, I mean, there were some good digs in here that are sort of fun to read. One of the things she said, Jesse, Helen Keller could have written a more accurate review of the production of Raisin and Son that we delivered.
Oh,
so that was a little, but here's one of the things she said. She said, your review says, quote, O'Hara concentrates his prodigious theatrical imagination on Walter Lee. What play did you see? A cursory view of the director's playbill notes explicitly states that this production's intent is to center the three women because Robert O'Hara asked, why is a play by a queer black woman with four black women characters known as a play about a black man's dreams? Misogynoir, and I'll talk about that in a second, is the answer. Your attention focused on Francois Baptiste's Walter Lee, and you projected that onto the production.
Hmm.
So she started the whole thing talking about misogynoir, that I've not heard this term before. I just learned it when reading this. Has anybody heard that term?
No.
So misogynoir is basically misogyny against black women.
Yeah.
And that's what she's accusing him of. So I thought it was really interesting. I would encourage folks to read it because I think, especially for those of us, and full disclosure, the majority of us here in this room talking are white people. And so my experience is different from hers, although we are the same age. I learned a lot reading this, and I would encourage other folks to read it. So I do want to, and I need to see if I can find this. If not, I'll just do it by memory. But it really has nothing to do with the content of this, but something I wanted to talk about, which is, well, as a director, when I direct a show, the first thing I do, or I don't know, the first thing I do, I basically throw out all stage directions, right? And in A Raisin in Sun, there's a slap that's written into the stage directions. And she rightfully says, the stage directions is what comes of the very first production of a show, and it's usually coming from the stage manager's book. It's not typically the author's intent. I mean, there are authors like Albee and things like that that they're all about the stage directions. But I just found it interesting that she brought that up, which is true. So many of us, I don't know how y'all feel, so I'm just basically stating my opinion, get caught up in the stage directions, that's some sort of dictate from the playwright, which normally it isn't.
Well, right. It's a guide, but it's certainly not set in stone.
Correct.
Well, and generally, too, you can tell if it is something that the playwright put in there or yes. if it was something that was added in as stage directions from another production. There's generally a difference.
And we have stopped there because I've gone over time.
Oh, no.
Oh. And I had a big list of things to talk about. So we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back and talk to you about the reason why you're here. Sure. And that's the show that's happening here. But we did talk about Lion King, which gave me the opportunity to play some music from The Lion King, which I just love. So we'll be right back. We are back. You're listening to Offstage and On the Air with Lisa and
Andrea Nunez
and
Huck Huckabee
and
Toby Miner
and
Ben Wolf.
And just as a reminder, this show, as all co-op shows, stream on KOOP.org. So let's reintroduce the folks from Austin Playhouse and the one act play that goes wrong. We have here the director, Mr. Ben Wolf.
Hello.
And then two of the actors, Toby Miner.
Hello, hello.
And Huck Huckabee.
Hello there.
The play that goes wrong.
Yeah.
What is it?
So I guess we're all familiar with the adage, you know, nobody likes to know how the sausage is made. Mm-hmm. And this show dares to ask, what happens when the sausage casing breaks when you're making that sausage? The Cornley Polytechnic Drama Society is putting on their biggest show to date, and they need it to go well in order to survive. And mysteriously, things continue to go wrong on stage, and they just have to deal with it and try to put on the best show they can. This version is the one act play that goes wrong, which is the original version that they wrote and produced, which then became the full length two act version that most people have seen. Mm-hmm. We decided to go with a one act version because there's a lot that goes wrong, and we needed to make sure we could handle all of it.
To do it, yeah. Because I saw the touring company that came here. That show was technically complex.
Very.
Yeah. So I assume the magicians at Austin Playhouse are equally.
We are working complex. Our magic. We're ready for an audience to tell us if this magic is working or not.
Right. Huck Huckabee, tell me about the role you play.
I play Dennis, who plays Perkins the butler. Dennis is somewhat slow on the uptake sometimes. Dennis also knows his lines, but sometimes he doesn't know his...
His words?
His words. And so I have a little gimmick that I use that helps me remember my words when I'm, but I can't tell you that.
Oh, I was hoping you'd share with us.
Oh, well, it's a visual thing, so you can't see it.
So, but I mean, if I wanted to, I could come see the show and I'd probably learn at that point.
Yes, you could
learn.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Dennis and what was the character's name? Dennis.
Perkins.
Dennis Perkins
the butler.
Dennis and Perkins the butler. And so obviously you sort of hinted that this is a play within a play.
Right, it is.
Okay, and Toby, who are you playing?
I play Robert, who is playing Thomas Collymore, who is kind of the head of the house within the play, and the actor character in the play is, he's been with the Polytechnic Players for a while, and he's trying to be the best actor he can possibly be, but is he that good?
Is he?
We don't see him.
So is there, I think a lot of people are familiar with Noises Off,
yeah.
Which is a similar conceit of a play within a play. And there, in that situation, there are two plots. Are there two plots here as well?
There's, you know, we've created our own sort of framing mm-hmm. device so that the player characters have their own little stories, but in terms of what is written on the page, it's 95% the play within the play. It's the murder at Haversham Manor. You get a brief introduction by a couple of the characters early on, and then it's just that.
I vacation at Haversham Manor, by the way. Yeah, that's my family did for years.
There's in the programs you'll have the bios for the characters at Cornley Polytechnic.
The players,
oh, the actors.
Yeah. Now, did y'all write those bios?
Yes,
we did.
Oh, what fun!
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you. Well, it could be fun. You could also, like Ben says, to do that, and you go, "Oh, darn you, Ben! I don't want to do that." But I would think it'd be a fun exercise.
Everybody smiled at me when I told them they had to do it. So
it was great.
That's a great idea. Well, y'all prepared to do a little scene, are you not?
Sure.
Great. Does somebody want to set that up?
Sure. So this is the beginning of the show. I don't think I'm giving away anything to say that when the, quote, curtain opens, there's a dead body on stage. So we discover early on this is a murder mystery. And then these two characters are coming in and will discover the body eventually.
Wonderful. Well, this is Toby Miner and Huck Huckabee doing a scene from Austin Playhouse's production of the one-act play That Goes Wrong.
Charlie, are you ready? We're all waiting downstairs to raise a glass to your engagement. Charlie! Oh, come along now, Charlie. You've been in there for hours now. If I didn't know better, I'd say you were having second thoughts about the wedding. Now, hang it all, Charlie. If you won't come out, I'll come in. Dang it. He's locked the door. Hand me those keys, Perkins.
Here they are, Mr. Collymore.
Thank you, Perkins. Now, let's get this door open. We're coming in, Charlie. We're coming in. Oh! It won't open.
What?
It won't open. The door, it won't.
What do we do?
It's stuck. I don't.
What?
Hold on. There we are. We're in. But what's this? Charles, unconscious?
Asleep, surely, Mr. Collymore.
Blast it, Perkins. I hope so.
I'll take his pulse.
Blast! I knew something was wrong. It's so unlike Charles to disappear like this.
Sir, he's dead.
Dead? Blast it, Perkins. He can't be. He's my closest friend.
He's not breathing, sir. And there's no hint of a heartbeat.
I'm dumbfounded. He was right as rain an hour ago.
I don't understand. He was fit as a fiddle. He can't be dead. It doesn't make sense.
Of course it makes sense. He's been murdered. Good God, where's Florence?
In the dining room, sir. Shall I fetch her?
No, not yet. The last thing we need is for her to have one of her hysterical episodes.
Yes, sir. Do you think it was murder, Mr. Collymore? Or do you think perhaps it was suicide?
Suicide? Charlie, not possible. There never was a man with more zest for life than Charlie. He was young, rich, and soon to be married. Why on earth would he commit suicide?
But why on earth would anyone want to murder him, sir? Charles was such a good man. A kind, generous, a true philanthropist. He never had an enemy in his life.
Until today, it seems. Blast it, Perkins. Charles Havisham was murdered in cold blood in this very room, on this very day, in this very room.
Shall I telephone the police, Mr. Collymore?
The police? They wouldn't make it out here for days in this snowstorm. I'll telephone Inspector Carter. He lives just the other side of the village. He'll be here in next to no time. Hand me the receiver, Perkins. Thank you, Perkins. Good evening. Give me Inspector Carter. I know it's late. Blast it, I don't care about the weather. There's been a murder. Someone's murdered Charles Havisham. That's right. Thank you.
Inspector Carter?
Yes, they say he's the best inspector in the district. He'll crack this case and quick.
Very good, sir. And what shall I do?
Lock every door, man. Not a soul gets out of Havisham Manor until the killer is found.
At once, sir.
And assemble everyone in here.
Right away, sir.
Right away, sir. That's amazing. How much fun is that?
Yeah. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, what you heard was 3 pages of dialogue and about
15 sight gags. Yeah, there's so much going on in that.
Well, first of all, I will say, I thankfully, the video wasn't running here because we did see how the lines come about here because we were fortunate enough to be here. So I won't say anything about it, but I know now.
Yeah.
So thank you. I was just talking actually before you got here, Ben, but we were talking ahead of time about physical comedy.
Oh, yeah.
And how difficult that is to put together and direct. How's that been for you?
It's certainly been a challenge, but we've put together an incredible group of players, and it's been a truly collaborative process from the beginning. I ran out of ideas, and the cast and the crew, literally everybody came together and said, well, let's try this and let's try that.
Most of the sight gags, they're not in the script.
Right.
Yeah.
It's on you. Or on the cast and the director.
I mean, it is a workout for them, for sure.
And that's actually one of the things that's lovely about having a really good cast is it becomes a true collaboration, especially with physical comedy. It's so hard. So we have about 25% of the cast here right now. Who else is in the show?
We've also got Sarah Chong Harmer, Owen Ziegler, Scott Shipman, Liz Beckham. Thank you. Chase Brewer.
Ben Bazan.
And Ben Bazan.
Yeah, so amazing cast.
Incredible.
Know them all. There's not a. You don't have a. You don't have there a dud
a,
in the bunch.
There is not
like.
A weak link. I promise you. This is such a fun show.
And then the set is part of the cast.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Of course it is. Yeah. Who did the set?
Mike Toner and Laura Toner co-designed it together.
Awesome. Well, wonderful. We're just about out of time. When does this show open?
The show opens this Friday, November 18th, and runs through
December 18th.
Yeah, easy 18th. To remember.
That's right.
And where can folks go to get more information?
You can get information and tickets through our website, austinplayhouse.com.
Well, great. Well, thank you all so much for coming on the show.
Yes, thank you for having us.
Wonderful. That was Ben Wolf, Toby Miner, and Huck Huckabee of Austin Playhouse production of the one-act play That Goes Wrong from November 18th through December 18th. For more information, you may visit austinplayhouse.com. And we're going to go out with, from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, What Could Possibly Go Wrong? We'll be right back.
Here in the bosom of America.
We are back. You're listening to Offstage and On the Air with Lisa Sheps and
Andrea Nunez.
And we just had a lovely conversation with the folks from Austin Playhouse on the one-act play That Goes Wrong. Have you ever seen the show, Andrea?
I have not seen the show, but I do know the wonderful adage, the show must go wrong.
The show must go wrong. That is a good adage.
Adage.
Since we're mispronouncing things, that's a good one. Mm-hmm. I should say we're going to talk about a local stuff here. And one of the things I neglected to mention last week on the local section was when this was played last time, I had such a hard time pronouncing it. Cenicienta. Which is a Glass Half Full production playing at Zach Theater it started on the 12th of this month and plays through December 3rd. So it's something that I did not get to see last time they played, and I'm hopefully going to get to see it this time. Have you seen it?
I have not.
Okay. Well, then we can both see it.
Yeah.
Other things playing right now are These Shining Lives at Mary Moody Northern Theater at St. Ed's. You can see One Last Chance to See It this weekend. Austin Shakespeare's Sense and Sensibilities through the 27th of this month. Archive Theater, who will be on this show next week, is playing Sherlock Holmes, which opens tomorrow and plays through December 18th. And of course, unless you're living under a rock, you don't know. Unless you're living under a rock, whatever it is, Zach Theater is doing Christmas Carol. It's opening today, tonight, on the 16th, plays through the 21st. Then, of course, we had them on the show last week, Water by the Spoonful, from different stages. Playing at the Vortex is playing through December 3rd. Before we leave this local section, I think you can tell people, you, Andrea, are performing in a show right now.
Yes, I am.
Can you tell folks a little bit about it? Is it good for the public to hear?
Well, I am a part of Safe Alliance's Where's Your Line, which we tour high schools in order to facilitate and showcase a theater performance on how to have healthy relationships. We think it's so important for high schoolers to start realizing things now about what it takes to have healthy boundaries and know what we want or don't want. And it's also, in the world of TikTok, they already just know so much.
They do, don't they?
And I think adults nowadays, we're very bogged down by a lot of responsibilities, so relationships should be very much an important thing that we shouldn't feel drained by and be uplifted by instead.
Well, great. I'm glad you're doing that work. And I know we are really fortunate to have Safe Alliance here in Austin, and the work they do is really important.
Very important.
Yeah. So, so great. But this is not open to the public, so our listeners can't see it.
We're hoping to do a performance possibly at the end of either this semester or next semester of our high school performances that may be open to the public. We will try to find a location for that, but more details on that later, because we believe anybody can come watch.
Lovely. Well, that's good. Well, thank you for sharing that with us.
Thank you.
So do you want to learn about today in theater history?
I would love to learn.
Okay. Well, in 1959, when I was 1 year old, Sound of Music opened. Do you like Sound of Music?
Old.
1 year, I'm old.
I love the Sound of Music.
Yep. And then also, we talk about this a lot on this show. Merrily We Roll Along opened on this date in 1981. And here's where what we've always talked about on the show, because people are sick of me talking about Oh Brother, which is the show I was in that was right across the street from Merrily We Roll Along. I thought we opened a week before Merrily We Roll Along, but as it turns out, we opened a week after Merrily We Roll Along, because we opened on the 21st. Mary Poppins opened on the 2006.
Oh.
Which I went to see and was, I didn't like it. I was so excited to see it on Broadway. I may as well say that here sitting in the studio with us is Andy Berkofsky and Steve Wright, in case you want to join in on any of this conversation. I just let you know that you're here with us. So say hello. Well, yeah, you know what? It would be better if I turned on your microphone and then people could hear you.
Hey,
someday.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
What about you, Steve? Say hello.
Hi.
Thanks for having us. Okay, great. And I'm going to ask you when you're talking the microphone to get as close to it as I am to mine. In 1968, Zorba opened. And in 1989, the revival of Gypsy.
Hmm.
That's it. Birthdays. Donna McKechnie. Who was Cassie in Chorus Line, amongst other things. Hmm. Andy is giving me a nod, which doesn't really work on radio.
I know. I want to chime in, but we could probably talk for a long time.
I figured as soon as I do that.
Merrily We Roll Along or Chorus Line or, yeah.
Well, and you're welcome to. Well, absolutely. Actually, anytime, the more we talk, we take away from talking about your show.
Right, so, right, correct.
Mary Poppins, I know. Other birthdays, Martha Plimpton, who I love. George S. Kaufman in 1889. I was not born yet. And Paula Vogel. And I was just talking about Paula Vogel. I was talking about because Austin Playhouse, who is just here, is doing Indecent.
Right.
Which was written by Paula Vogel, which I cannot wait to see. I that show is just so amazing.
And she did How I Learned to Drive.
She did.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
We're revealing some of those shows that we may are thinking about for our 23 season, and that's maybe
there you
one
go.
Of those. Yeah,
yeah, but Ground Floor Theater's already doing it.
Oh well,
I'm teasing. anyway, so that's today in theater history. Let's take a break. We'll listen to a little bit of Merrily We Roll Along because, well, why not? Any excuse. We are specifically going to be listening to. I didn't staple my papers together, so I don't know. Old Friend, Part 2, from the, I believe this is the 2006 revival. Here it is, hopefully.
So, old friend, fill me in slow.
We are old back. Friend, you are still listening to Offstage and On the Air with Lisa and Andrea. We just had a lovely, very short conversation with ourselves, as well as Andy Berkofsky and Steve Wright. And now we're going to switch our thinking and on our subject to the City Theater and their production of Faith Healer. And we have Andy Berkofsky, who's the artistic director of City Theater and the director of this piece.
Yes.
I did it again. I didn't turn your microphone on.
Yes. Yeah, artistic director and director of Faith Healer, yes.
And Steve Wright, who's one of the performers in the show.
That's right.
That's right, then. So, Andy, tell us about Faith Healer. What is it? It's actually been around for since the 70s.
It has, yeah. It's an older play, but the relevancy is pretty wild from what's happening today. Faith Healer is basically what the title implies. It's about a man and his clan, his trio, that travels from town to town. He is faith healing, you know, the desperate, the helpless and homeless, trying to find their peace with themselves or what they have going on. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. The clan that he, the people that he have with him is his wife, Grace, well, mistress, he calls her a couple of different things within the context of the play. And then Teddy, who is his road manager that sets up each time that they go to a hall each day as they move to the next town and town and town. And that's basically what the premise is all about, what they've gone through, their pasts, how they recollect on the things that they have gone through, what they with their parents, the relationship with other people. And it kind of then culminates into the story of three or four different stories that kind of come together into one kind of moment as we get towards
and
the
end
of the play.
And it's got sort of an open-ended. We don't really know the fate of the faith healer at the end.
Correct. That's the fascinating thing about the play is that there is that open-ended. And it's really, and I'm going to, you know, we want to when we go to the theater, we want to allow ourselves to think. And sometimes in the entertainment value of it, you know, 2 hours pass and next thing you know, you're off, you know, doing whatever. And I think, you know, for this one, we're really going to push that hard with our audience to allow themselves to be, to wrap themselves into the story as it gets to where we need to have it happen at the very, very end. And it is, it's left to debate.
Yep.
It's left to discuss at the end. So I'm hoping our audience is to do that, you know, and I'm going to try to make sure as I wrap myself in, you know, the curtain speech and as the audience arrives to allow themselves to do that, you know, at the end of the play.
So. Wonderful. Now, Steve, you're playing the manager.
That's right.
I know that because you gesticulated when Andy mentioned it. Tell us about your character. What's his name?
His name is Teddy.
Teddy.
Teddy, yeah.
Okay. Tell us about the character.
Well, he's a Cockney, and he's a fun character to play because he's outrageous. He dresses tackily, but he's the driver of the van that takes them around. So he's watching this couple. And so his story is fascinating because you hear his story, her story, and then the third story. And even reading the script, I said, wait, she said that, he said that. And then I say something different happened. So right. It's fun.
So I have not seen it nor read it, but I did look at the Wikipedia page. And it was somewhat vague, but is it set up as four monologues?
It is set up as four monologues. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is set up that way. And that's, again, what's compelling about it is Brian Frell's writing of those stories where, you know, when I first read the play, I thought this is beautiful piece of work. And when you're reading it, you want it. Actually, I went back a lot in reading the play. Now, you know, Lisa, I know you do too, to pick up on stuff. Did I hear this in this part or what? Mm-hmm. You know, in this part, and we're trying to make sure we really clarify that, you know, in real time as far as the actors, because there's the writing of it gets to a point where you want to grab the stuff from the other stories, and then like what Steve was saying is it. What are these characters believing, you know, what really happened in real life? And also, what are they believing in? It's that whole idea of, you know, that, you know, of what is truth nowadays, and what if somebody's sticking to the truth, that is their truth.
Right.
And so when you have these stories coming together like this, it then, like you say, with the audience, they're allowed to then go, did that really happen? Did it not? And the thing about with Teddy's character, he's the outsider looking in at the very end. So his story really becomes a lot more weighted at the very end because you've already heard these other stories from the other two characters.
Right. And the other two characters are indeed the faith healer and his partner.
Correct. Yeah.
And who are the actors playing those other two?
Our faith healer is Rick Smith.
Mm-hmm.
He was in our production of Virginia Woolf and has done a couple of shows with us too. And then Dawn Aaron, who's playing Grace, he's the partner, the mistress of, and she's been in a couple of shows of ours as well.
So I'm curious, so City Theater, who has used to be like right next door to us here at Co-op Studios, has been without a home, and you're now a little less itinerant that you were, that you have a home that you're going to be performing in this season. What is the significance of this show for City Theater at this point in your history?
That's a good question.
I'm filled with good questions.
Yeah, I know you are, absolutely. For the start of our season, which is normally we do a fall to fall season, so we're kind of leading into, even though we're really going to get the bigger start when 2023 happens. So it was a good show to start off with at our new residency at the Fellowship Hall at Genesis Presbyterian. So. Because we are dropping a theater into their hall.
Sure.
You know, so, and it's so far so good with everything. And it was a perfect little show to start everything with. And a show which it's a premiere show in Austin. I think there's some, they've done some workshops, and I think some of the festivals have done it. So I thought that would be a perfect show. Not necessarily any kind of relevancy to being at a, you know, at the Genesis, but it was just right for the start of, you know, to start of what we're doing. And you know, the part that we, the idea that we're being so close to this area, I'm sure. it's wonderful to be back over
yeah,
here.
Yeah, you're right down the street from here.
Correct, absolutely.
Well, we should say that this show had played on Broadway in the 70s, didn't do so well, played like 20 performances, I think, and then it had a revival, I think, in 2006. Actually, I don't know if that's right. I've been using 2006 a lot in
yeah,
my...
Yeah, it's what Brian... And that
and that
happen.
Ran for a while.
Yeah, it did. And it was so there's some interesting information about that, how when it didn't... When it died, Mr. Frobel was like, I don't know if I want to do this again.
Yeah, sure.
Whatever happened. And then when they brought it back to London, and I can't think of the London Hall... where they brought it back, he said, no, let's do it. Let's yep. see what happens. And it did. It was more about the directing style. And that's a good point that you're bringing up, was that when it played in on Broadway, it had a big house.
Yep.
And they wanted to invite thousands. And he talks about the intimacy of the show,
sure.
which is really important. And so when they brought it back to London, it had a smaller house. It was more intimate. You were in on the action as you watch, and that's what's, you know, we're trying to work for
sure.
at Fellowship Hall. Yeah. At the same time.
I will say that the revival, whenever it was, it did garner best revival nomination,
yeah.
For Tony. So it they evidently did something, or it was just the way it was. We're almost out of time. Time flies so quickly. Tell us when you open, when you close.
We have our preview show tomorrow, opening on Friday. So tomorrow's the 17th. So November 17th through December 11th. So it's 4 weekends. Not doing the show the Thursday and Friday of
Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving.
Right. That's probably smart.
But do it Saturday and Sunday. So through December 11th. Yeah.
Awesome. And where can folks go to get information?
CityTheaterAustin.org.
Well, thank you all so much for coming on.
Thank you much.
Thank you.
Okay. That was Andy Burkowski and Steve Wright of City Theater's production of The Faith Healer. From November 17th through December 11th. For more information, citytheateraustin.org. And I should say this is at their new home at the Genesis Fellowship Hall, the Genesis Presbyterian Church. And we're going to go out with, of course, I had to play Leap of Faith for this. This is I Can Read You. Andrea, we did it. We did an hour. It went so fast. It went so fast. What are your thoughts?
I loved it. It was so well-rounded, the discussion. I feel like I had a lot to say more sociologically about the news and theater with racial discrimination and what have you.
That's true. Coming up next is John Hoffner, who's trying to rip the microphone away from me right now with the Austin Common Radio Hour. John, what's going on today?
Well, believe it or not, we still have elections, and everybody's exhausted from elections.
Hey, you've got the runoffs now.
We've got runoffs, so we're talking to the mayor.
Oh, awesome.
Candidates again today. So
okay, both of them?
Stuff. Both.
Awesome. Two. Wonderful. That's it's always good. I've been really enjoyed listening to that. So we're going to go out with a new, well, it's a show called Knoxville that Oslo Rep did in Florida, and they have a new cast album that goes out. So, Andre, thank you. We'll see you again next time.
Thank you for having me, Lisa.
So we'll be back next week when we look at what's happening offstage and on the air, and this is Father to Son from Knoxville.
Son, Father to Son.